This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
I'm interviewing Dr. Antonio Crisostomou and Dr. Mark Thompson, who are respectively from the Joint Astronomy Centre in Hawaii and the University of Hertfordshire. So there was a whole session about an instrument called SCUBA 2, which is part of the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope. So could you tell us a bit about what that does?
SCUBA 2 is a submillimeter camera. It's been built in the last... project took about 10 years to come to fruition because it was using state-of-the-art technology on three different lines, really. There's the detectors themselves, the first time that we can actually build now an array of pixels which are sensitive enough to submillimeter radiation. I can say something about what that is. And also the fridge, what we use to keep the instrument cold, is also state-of-the-art. And so all of that kind of technology kind of came together. It was a high-risk, high-return type of project. In the last few years now, we finally got onto the telescope and pointing at the sky in the last 6 months or so, and it's getting some great results.
Okay, so the submillimeter band is something that, I guess, for a long time it wasn't very easy to do observations in, but that's now becoming more and more practical.
Yeah, the submillimeter is very difficult to observe from, certainly from the ground, you know. It's impossible. You're not going to do that because there's too much water in the atmosphere, and water is the principal molecule which is obstructing the radiation from reaching the ground, which is why space is probably the best way to do submillimeter astronomy. It's also the most expensive way of doing it. Mm-hmm. The other option you have is to go very high onto a mountain to minimize the amount of atmosphere there is above the telescope. And such a place you find in Hawaii, which has this... tall volcano. It's a what they call a sheer volcano, which means it's got very liquid, very fluid lava, which is how the volcano's formed. It's about 14,000 feet high, but because it's what they term a sheer volcano, means it's actually quite easy to build a road and climb up it with a truck, you know, with a big truck to transport all the material up there to build your observatories. So really what you need is that height. The other thing that you need is a kind of a weather system which will keep moisture from coming up from the ground, you know, where all the tropical rainforests are. And we kind of have that in Hawaii with kind of a really good inversion layer below. So above the mountains up, it's really very, very dry, one of the driest places on the planet, which is ideal for doing submillimeter astronomy.
I see. So, Mark, maybe I could ask you, as someone who will be using SCUBA 2, mm-hmm. I mean, the submillimeter is between radio and infrared, so what does it tell you particularly about astronomy that we can't find out from other wavelengths?
Well, it's really, it's where radio astronomy and infrared astronomy collide, essentially, and objects that emit in a submillimeter are generally very cold. So it gives us a window on the cold universe, the universe that's maybe only 10 or 20 degrees above absolute zero, and... primarily what we observe with SCUBA 2 is dust, not common or garden household dust, but dust that is created in space from either supernovae or from evolved stars. And the dust at 20 Kelvin is really involved in star formation, forming new stars, and galaxy formation and evolution. So it gives us the whole picture across the universe from the, you know, some of the first galaxies to form all the way to the very most recent stars that have formed in our own Milky Way.
And will it be sensitive enough, then you're saying, to look quite far back into the universe's history?
Oh, well, the submillimeter is very unique because there's an effect called negative K correction. And that basically means that if you're looking at a galaxy in the submillimeter, particularly at 850 microns where SCUBA 2 works, the galaxy is essentially the same brightness almost anywhere in the universe, from a redshift of, say, around 1 to a redshift of 10.
How strange.
It works basically because if you have a galaxy and you redshift that galaxy, one of the things you do is you make the galaxy fainter. The other effect that you have is redshifting it. You're moving the emission from the blue end of the spectrum to the red end of the spectrum. And the two effects combine to essentially mean that at 850 microns, the galaxies are... constant brightness.
Okay, but you may not be observing the same original wavelengths as
no,
you, as
no, you no, at, say a redshift of a few, you're observing emission in the far infrared that's been redshifted into the 850 micron band, and that emission is generally much brighter, and that's what levels everything off. So SCUBA 2 is great for finding these galaxies, and it's also great for studying star-forming regions in our own galaxy.
Excellent. Okay, well, maybe I can just ask both of you what sort of projects you think are going to be coming out of Scuba 2 in the next few years.
Well, the main science program that we've got in place now, really, over the last few years for Scuba 2 is what we're calling the JCMT Legacy Surveys. Now, these surveys are basically what they want to do is to determine the origins of the things that they're studying. And that's all the way from how planets form around nearby stars, these so-called debris disks, which some of your listeners might be familiar with, to how stars form in our galaxy, whether they're low-mass stars in our neighbourhood or high-mass stars further out. And then we move on to the local galactic neighbourhood, away from the Milky Way, trying to understand the how gases and dust kind of work together in a nearby spiral galaxies or elliptical galaxies. So we have a project to do that. And then moving even further back, as we've just heard, moving in the more cosmological distances at high redshift to see how the early galaxies in the universe first formed. And as Mark just told you, because of this correction that all galaxies are more or less of the same brightness through our cosmological history back to just after the Big Bang, the submillimeter is really, really good at finding these things, and then you can follow up with other instrumentations. But you need the submillimeter to find where these galaxies are through history.
Yeah. So as you're going back in history, are you looking at progressively warmer things? Is that a reasonable thing to say? Or?
Not necessarily. It's not the fact that they are warmer. They are maybe more active. Mm-hmm. So we know from what we have learned from Scuba 2's predecessor, imaginatively called Scuba, without the number. Now, what Scuba did, one of its claims to fame was to discover this population of submillimeter galaxies, as they're called. Actually, some people still refer to them as Scuba galaxies. Uh-huh. What Scuba did was open up this window in the submillimeter to observe these galaxies. Before, the population of these sources just wasn't known. We didn't know that these galaxies existed. And so we had this idea of what the star formation history was like through the history of the universe. And we thought that most of the star formation, most galaxies form their own redshift of one or something. And it was only when we discovered these submillimeter bright galaxies. And the reason that they are bright in the submillimeter but we could not see them in the optical is because they're basically enshrouded by dust. And because there is so much dust, the light in the optical cannot escape, cannot get out. It's just like a fog. And so that light cannot get out, and so it looks dark in the optical. But because that dust is actually very active in forming stars, mm-hmm. and we know that from studies in the Milky Way, when we study star formation, is that it always happens in these very dark and dense regions. And mm-hmm. that's true in all cosmological history. So these galaxies have been very active, but they were being very active in forming stars in an earlier time, around redshifts of 2, 3, 4. And so that wasn't long before. It was only when we discovered those with Scuba and that we were able to kind of basically invent a new research field, which is submillimeter cosmology.
Excellent. Is there anything you want to add to that about the program of Scuba 2?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm coordinating one of the legacy surveys, which is called SASSI, which stands for the Scuba 2 Ambitious Sky Survey.
Right.
And we're hoping to make one of the largest area surveys from the ground at this wavelength to look for very cold molecular clouds in the galaxy, which are just on the verge of forming stars. One of the problems in star formation is that, and particularly in massive star formation, is that when a star forms, it immediately alters its environment beyond all recognition.
Right.
And so trying to understand how these things form means we have to really find the very early stages. And Scuba's ideal for that because it's optimised to look for cold emission. And the other thing is that we're highly complementary to Herschel Space Observatory. We extend the wavelength coverage of Herschel, and we have a better resolution, so we can see sharper details. So, yes, we're very excited to be doing this survey, and also the fact we're pioneering operations at the JCMT in wetter conditions than they've generally observed in before. So we're hoping to be bigger, faster and moister.
Excellent. So you mean to say that you can mitigate the effects of a little bit more water in the atmosphere now?
Yes, I mean, one of the things that's gone into Scuba 2 is an awful lot of trying to understand the data reduction and how to take out the effects of the atmosphere. And SCUBA 2 takes data a lot faster than its predecessor. We take data at a rate of 200 hertz. So we can track changes in the water vapour, we can solve for the atmosphere, and we take it out. And so essentially, in moister conditions, mean that we just have to look at the thing for longer.
Right, you're just doing weather monitoring and you're able to
take
out the effect.
We can take it out. We just need to take a longer exposure. Whereas with SCUBA, you wouldn't be able to do that. It just was not possible to work in these conditions very effectively.
So SCUBA 2 is obviously built on what SCUBA did, but it's taken it quite a bit further than...
Yes, SCUBA opened up some limited astronomy for astronomers. But what SCUBA 2 is doing is because it's effectively, we are the first instrument to bring CCD technology to the submillimeter. And because of that, we can maximize the field of view that the instrument sees through our telescope. So we're able to actually look at a much larger piece of sky with any single exposure, whereas SCUBA only had a very small kind of keyhole view of the sky. So because of that, we can actually now survey larger areas in a more efficient manner than we could ever before. And so now survey astronomy, which is something that the optical astronomers and infrared astronomers have had for a number of years, has now opened up to the submillimeter astronomers. And so this is, the thing that's making everybody excited now. So we're going to get large populations. We're going to be able to do statistics, proper statistics in the submillimeter, which we haven't been able to do before.
Okay, thank you very much.